This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Israel and Hamas announced a ceasefire to end a bruising 11-day war that caused widespread destruction in the Gaza Strip and brought life in much of Israel to a standstill. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office announced late Thursday that his security cabinet approved the Egyptian-mediated proposal. Hamas quickly followed suit and said it would honor the deal. In remarks, U.S. President Joe Biden says there's genuine opportunity to make progress toward peace.
I believe the Palestinians and Israelis equally deserve to live safely and securely and to enjoy equal measures of freedom, prosperity, and democracy.
And in response, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres says that the people of Gaza will need assistance to rebuild.
I appeal to the international community to work with the United Nations on developing an integrated, robust package of support for a swift, sustainable reconstruction and recovery that supports the Palestinian people and strengthens their institutions. I stress that Israeli and Palestinian leaders have a responsibility beyond the restoration of calm to start a serious dialogue to address the root causes of the conflict.
The White House said Thursday that North Korea will be a key topic when U.S. President Joe Biden meets with South Korean President Moon Jae-in Friday. Moon has been hoping to use his first summit with U.S. President Joe Biden this week to press a legacy policy of engaging North Korea, as Washington has played down the prospect of any quick impetus on the issue. Biden is set to prioritize boosting cooperation with Seoul on regional security more broadly. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The UN Refugee Agency has made an unusual plea for the Biden administration to lift pandemic-related restrictions on people seeking asylum in the United States. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi on Thursday asked for an end to the so-called Title 42 authority. It's named for a section of an obscure 1944 U.S. public health law that former President Donald Trump used last year to effectively end asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border. President Biden has kept the policy in place, though he exempted children traveling alone. Grandi says that protecting public health and the right to seek asylum are fully compatible. A detention facility in the U.S. state of Georgia where women claim they were subjected to unwanted medical procedures and a Massachusetts jail that has drawn complaints of inhumane conditions will no longer be used to detain immigrants, according to the Biden administration. The Department of Homeland Security said it would terminate contracts with the local government agency that runs the detention center in North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and with the private operator of the Irwin County Detention Center in Georgia. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, a part of the DHS, has already significantly reduced the detainee population at both facilities. Any detainees the U.S. believes should remain in custody will be transferred elsewhere. That's according to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, announcing the move, which had been sought by immigrant advocates. Fewer Americans sought unemployment aid last week. That's the latest encouraging sign for the rebounding U.S. economy, just as Republican-led states are moving to cut off a federal benefit for the jobless. 23 states, from Texas and Georgia to Ohio and Iowa, plan to begin blocking a $300 a week federal payment for the unemployed starting in June. According to an Associated Press analysis, jobless people have been able to receive the $300 federal benefit on top of their regular state unemployment aid. Forecasters expect yet another busy Atlantic hurricane season this year, but they say it will not be as crazy as 2020. Thursday's forecast from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicts 30 to 20 named storms. It says 6 to 10 of those will become hurricanes. It forecasts that 3 to 5 will be major hurricanes with winds of more than 110 miles per hour. That's more than the average year, but again, not like 2020 when forecasters had to dip into the Greek alphabet for names. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 21st. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian Senator Prince Johnson expresses surprise for being called a notorious warlord.
Whoever is accused is presumed innocent under due process in court. You have not indicted me. I have never been tried. Why would the superpower of the world, why would they refer to a senator like me as a notorious war criminal?
An Ethiopian opposition group calls for national dialogue before elections. A Zambian civil society group welcomes the decision now to hold public campaign rallies ahead of August election. The U.S. and African armies meet virtually, and the WHO says delays in delivery of COVID-19 vaccine to African countries is putting lives at risk.
This means that as people living in richer countries can hit the reset button this summer and their lives will return to a semblance of normal, in Africa, our lives will continue to be on hold.
And Kenya's president opens the country's second largest port at Lamu. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian Senator Prince White Johnson, the man who captured and murdered President Samuel Doe in the 1990s, says he's not afraid of the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. However, Johnson says there are statutes in Liberia that prevent the introduction of such a court. Johnson was leader of the former Independent National Patriotic Front of Liberia rebel group during Liberia's 14-year-long civil war and was said to have allegedly committed numerous human rights violations. This week, Johnson was elected chair of the Liberian Senate Committee on Defense and Intelligence. The U.S. Embassy in Liberia issued a statement referring to Johnson as a notorious warlord whose gross human rights violations during Liberia's civil war are well documented. Johnson called VOA to say he was shocked by the U.S. Embassy's statement for convicting him before being tried in a court of law.
It came to me as a shocking news because in that release, they call me notorious war criminal. This body, I believe in America's dream. I believe in a judiciary or legal system. They do not call you that name unless you are given due process in court. So to call me a notorious war criminal, the highest level of criminality in a superlative degree, notorious, war notorious, is a shock to me because I served on that committee for 12 years, the first 6 years of the Salih regime, and we restructured the security sector reform. And whenever defense attache came from America to the embassy or was leaving, they would invite me to take part in the program or have dinner with them. And we have had cordial relationship. So I do not know why they have problem with this at this time when I was there for 20 years.
So, Senator, did you complain to the U.S. Embassy about this statement you say they have made?
We have not officially complained to the embassy, but my party has come up with a release that they believe in American democracy, international human rights, and legal system. But then what they say is a violation of their own law and our law, because whoever is accused is presumed innocent under due process in court. You have not indicted me. I have never been tried. I have never been sent to court. Why would the superpower of the world, our more closer ally, that we have been working with for decades, centuries, why would they refer to a senator like me as a notorious war criminal? You don't. They went too far. That is even against the legal system of America and the international law. You don't do that.
Senator, as you know, there's talk in Liberia about the establishment of a war crimes and economic crimes commission. As a security committee chair, are you in favor of that?
That's not only the point. The point is, why do you call me a notorious war criminal? I mean, I've been convicted. I only need to be sentenced now. When you call it for economic and war crime court, you already refer to me as a notorious war criminal. What is? So then you don't need a court now. For me, take me to jail. That's a violation of our constitution. It's a violation of the American international human rights. The justice you're seeking for would-be victim, you also should seek justice for the would-be perpetrator that you are accusing.
So, Senator, some people say if that is the way you feel, why not get behind this call to establish this war crimes court to let people know that you have nothing to hide?
Listen, I got nothing to hide. I got nothing but skeleton in my cupboard to hide. There are reasons why I speak the way I do. Whoever wants to do war crimes court, Senator Bilal, put a bill on the floor of the Senate and lobby your colleagues. Perhaps during the debate, it may be discovered that there is already amnesty law that was passed by the 51st legislature of the Republic of Liberia and Article 97 of our Constitution.
That was Senator Prince Johnson of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. In Ethiopia, representatives of the Oromo Liberation Front, OLF, and the Oromo Federalist Congress, the OFC, have called for a national dialogue before this year's elections. Merewa Gudina, the chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress, says the dialogue would focus on a peaceful democratic transition in Ethiopia. The group made the appeal Thursday when they met with more than 20 Western diplomats at the British Embassy in Addis Ababa. The meeting came as Ethiopia's Electoral Commission announced on Thursday that the June 5th parliamentary election, which was postponed last week, will now be held June 21st. Gudina says holding elections will make no difference in Ethiopia.
We are forced out of the elections. Whether it is June 21 or September 21, it does not make any difference. So we'll see what the outcome would be. Definitely the ruling party is going to stay with majority seats. But the election really does not make any difference.
You said that you met with members of the Western diplomatic community. What was the purpose of the meeting and the outcome?
Well, you know, the Western diplomatic community has got what we call a donors election working group coordinated by the British and the Swedish. So this is our second meeting regarding the elections and what is going on in the country. Four political groups, including myself, were there. They raised a lot of questions. We tried to answer in our own way. It is definitely a sort of...
You said that you strongly called for national dialogue. What would be the purpose of the dialogue?
So that without a real and honest national dialogue, the future Ethiopia to us is going to be probably full of more crises rather than creating this peaceful stability in the country or looking forward to what we call the hoped for democratic transition. So the magic formula is to all the major stakeholders, especially the sort of an all-inclusive dialogue is necessary. Otherwise, we are at a very critical crossroad and stuck.
You mentioned the pitfalls in the election process in Ethiopia. Did you tell the Western diplomats about these pitfalls? And what do you think the fact that the Ethiopian Elections Commission is going to have the election?
Yeah, but without, ensuring it is on independence and neutrality, it is going to conduct the election. And the election officials deployed across the country with very little knowledge of what the election means and their position compromised. The election board is really, for us, already lost its independence and probably trying to give a cover to the ruling party and one or two accomplices who want to see what we call electoral authoritarianism. That means a party losing elections to stay in power, not for the citizens, but to look good to the Western donors and continue to get some foreign aid and so on.
Thank you always for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you too.
Merera Gudina is chair of the Oromo Federalist Congress. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue, a civil society group, is hailing a decision by political parties not to hold public campaign rallies leading up to the August 12th general election. The parties say the move will help limit the spread of the coronavirus. The Technical Committee of the Electoral Commission of Zambia has established measures to help limit the spread of the disease. Maureen Unjovu Kabwe is the executive director for the Zambia Center for Interparty Dialogue. She tells VOA's Peter Clotty that her organization will continue to engage the political parties for their observers to observe COVID protocols.
And because we know that these political rallies can be high spreaders, And so for us as an institution that houses political party, an umbrella institution for political party, we are elated that politicians are prioritizing the health of their citizens. So yeah, this is where we are coming from.
Well, Doreen, some people are expressing concern that even though some of these political parties are observing the protocols to stop the spread of the disease, weeks to the elections, they expect party activities to increase. And that is where they fear that some of these protocols could be broken. How confident are you that these political parties will stick to these measures in order to ensure that people are protected from the disease?
We understand that it's not so much of an easy task, especially that when you look at power contestation, some political parties would go to lengths or extents of abrogating certain even pieces of legislation. And so we just have to put in some standards that political parties have to follow, which have already been stipulated. And we are appealing to political parties to familiarize themselves with these guidelines.
Doreen, some opposition political parties have accused the Electoral Commission of doing the bidding of the Patriotic Front or perhaps the government for using the COVID protocols implemented to stop their party activities ahead of the elections. What do you say to that?
For us, we saw this as an opportunity for political parties to actually ensure that they follow suit. However, if, as you have said, it is meant to deter or to prevent other political parties from holding rallies, I think it is too soon to conclude that. However, it will be seen. I mean, the campaign period just kicked off. So we will be able to see all the political parties that have made these pronouncements that we need to do away with rallies because we need to protect our citizens. We will be able to follow up and see if the pronouncements that are being made are actually met with the action that is needed.
That was Marie Njovu Kabwe, Executive Director for the Zambia Center for Inter-Party Dialogue. She was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 21st. The African Land Forces Summit brings together the might of the finest armies of Africa and the United States. The two armies meet biannually to discuss security threats on the continent and how they can tackle those threats together. The leader of the American cohort briefed journalists after this year's summit held virtually. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
In the 11 years since the U.S. Army began meeting with African land forces, the security landscape has changed significantly, says Major General Andrew Rowling. And so have the ways that militaries have tried to keep up with threats. The theme of the first summit, held in Washington in 2010, was building and maintaining strong relationships. This year, the whole event went virtual and was held over one day, with more than 40 countries represented, and with a much more negative theme, but with hope of more actual engagement in the future.
This year, the summit's theme was maintaining security in a degraded environment. We discussed military pandemic responses, the effects of the pandemic on operations, and its effects on training and exercises. Though we were not able to meet in person this year, I look forward to next year when I'm hoping and confident we surely will. We look forward to training with our counterparts through exercises and security cooperation activities in the near future.
In fact, Rowling said, the unit he commands, the U.S. Army's Southern European Task Force Africa, will meet up next month with partners in North Africa for African Lion 21, an exercise that had to be canceled last year because of the coronavirus pandemic. The inability to get actual boots on the actual ground because of pandemic restrictions has transformed the way these important partnerships work, Rowling said, but not necessarily for the worse. Previously, he says collaboration meant bringing 200 to 300 people under one tent. Now, he says,
what we've been able to do over the course of the pandemic is decentralize that activity into a point where what used to be side-by-side mission planning is now being done on collaborative tools such as Zoom and Microsoft Teams.
Specific threats discussed at this year's conference included terrorism and pandemic-related instability. When the group gathers again a year from now, all parties hope the pandemic will just be a memory. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says delays in the delivery of COVID-19 vaccines to countries in Africa is putting lives at risk and threatening the continued spread of the coronavirus on the continent and across borders. Today, the WHO says there are 4.7 million COVID-19 cases across Africa, including 127,000 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Shipments of COVID-19 vaccine to Africa slowed to a trickle earlier this month. Its main supplier, India's Serum Institute, retained the doses to tackle a devastating surge of domestic cases. That has essentially brought the rollout of the life-saving product across Africa to a screeching halt. So far, the WHO says only 24 million people in a continent of more than 1 billion have received at least one vaccine dose, and 5.5 million have received two doses. WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, deplores the inequities that exist between countries that have access to COVID-19 vaccine and those who do not. In Africa, she says fewer than 2 in 100 people, or 2%, have received one vaccine dose, compared to more than 8 out of 10 people, or 80%, in some high-income countries.
This means that as people living in richer countries can hit the reset button this summer, and their lives will return to a semblance of normal, in Africa, our lives will continue to be on hold. We can still catch up and make up for the lost ground, but time is running out.
Moeti says Africa is also suffering from a severe shortage of money to pay for the operational costs of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. She says urgent action and international solidarity is crucial in ensuring Africa can obtain the vaccines it needs and finance the rollout.
We welcome the pledge by the United States this week to share 80 million doses with other countries, with a substantial proportion expected to go through the COVAX, in addition to recent shipments of vaccines from France to Mauritania and pledges by several other high-income countries.
The World Bank estimates every month of delay in the provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Africa could cost the continent close to $14 billion in lost GDP. The financial institution so far has provided $1 billion to help 39 African countries tackle the pandemic. Last fall, its board of directors also approved a $12 billion package to help countries purchase and deploy COVID-19 vaccines. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta presided over the official opening of the country's second port after Mombasa in the northern city of Lamu. The Chinese-built $3 billion port will serve Ethiopia, South Sudan, and other landlocked nations and compete for transshipments with ports in Djibouti and South Africa. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
Speaking at the opening of the Lamu port, President Uhuru Kenyatta said it will be the gateway to the region.
So this indeed is a momentous feat, and it marks an important milestone towards the realization of our key objective of Vision 2030 to transform regional economies through increased trade, integration, and interconnectivity.
Kenya's Vision 2030 plan aims to transform the country into an industrial and middle-income economy. Construction of the Lamu port began in 2016. Since then, Kenya has been trying to woo its neighbors to use the port. In return, they will pay less for the goods that pass through. Kenyatta says the project is part of his country's effort to change the lives of its people.
A new chapter unfolds today in the development and transformation of Lamu, a chapter now that joins the transformation that is taking place in every part of our country.
Kenya already has a major port in Mombasa in the south of the country. Critics of the Chinese-built Lamu port say it may be of less economic value. Gerishon Ikiara is an international economic affairs lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He says Lamu Port's strategic location will help Kenya secure more revenue.
The Lamu Port will help Kenya to have an advantage in lower costs of transportation. It has shortened distance to especially Southern Sudan and the parts of Ethiopia. So Kenya will access greater markets now for those. It will be able to get revenue from cargo in transit coming through the port to other countries.
Most businesses in Ethiopia, the second populous nation in Africa, use the Djibouti port. Kenya wants businesses in southern Ethiopia to use the Lamu port. Ikiara says the political volatility in Ethiopia and South Sudan may lead to less use of the new facility. Kenya expects to complete the construction of the port in October and plans to invite leaders from neighboring states to show them its potential and negotiate a deal for their respective countries. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Africa Sports, and here is something. O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Cameroon, where a CAF delegation will arrive in Cameroon capital, Yaoundé, on Friday morning to begin an inspection tour in the country in preparation of next year's Total African Cup of Nations to be played in Cameroon. The inspection tour will begin on Saturday in Yaoundé. The delegation will comprise of experts from various fields, including competitions, events, marketing, broadcast TV, media, hospitality, security and various other divisions that are key in delivering a global tournament. Supported by FIFA experts, the delegation will assess the country's state of preparation and also discuss with specialists from the local organizing committee the possible technical support needed. In Tunisia, the curtain officially fell on the 2020-2021 Tunisian League season, with the final game week played on Wednesday. Esperance de Tunis emerged champions for the 31st time in their history and the fifth in a row, dominating the football scene in Tunisia. Despite their 2-1 loss against ES Matloui, Esperance was already guaranteed their title, finishing the competition on 60 points, 10 more than closest rivals Etoile du Sahel. And on to beach soccer, with just a few days before the kickoff of the Beach Soccer African Cup of Nations Senegal 2021, DR Congo has withdrawn from the tournament. Federation Congolese du Football Association confirmed the withdrawal of the Democratic Republic of Congo's national team from the Beach Soccer African Cup of Nations. DR Congo qualified for the final tournament after their opponents Cote d'Ivoire withdrew from the qualifiers. The tournament will now be played with 7 teams, and Group A will be composed of Senegal, Uganda, and Tanzania. Group B remains unchanged. It includes Egypt, Morocco, Mozambique, and Seychelles. Ugandan Sand Cranes player Emmanuel Wasar says they've got their eyes on the finals of the competition.
We expect to play in the finals because all our goal is to play in the World Cup. And to play in the World Cup, we have to play finals. It is one goal, one team. And you know, when we work as a team, we shall achieve our goal to play in the World Cup in Russia.
And now to athletics, where Caster Semenya will make another bid for Tokyo Olympic qualification in the 5,000 meters in Durban on Friday. According to her SA-based manager, Leroy Newton, Caster Semenya has switched her focus to the 5,000 meters after she was barred from competing in her favorite 800 meters event when World Athletics regulations prohibited women with differences of sexual development from competing in distances between 400 meters and the mile, unless they took hormone-suppressing drugs. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.